From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
There may be a hidden ingredient in the chocolate cake you baked, the candy bars your children sold for their school fundraiser, or that fudge ripple ice cream cone you enjoyed on Saturday afternoon. Slave labor.
Today, a taste of slavery. We follow the trail of chocolate from the Ivory Coast, where enslaved boys harvest cocoa, to the mouths of babes in Europe and here in the United States. You're listening to Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Washington Post is reporting today a confidential informant for the Drug Enforcement Administration compromised dozens of prosecutions across the United States by falsely testifying under oath and concealing his own arrest record, but the DEA continued to employ him for 16 years, despite detailed knowledge of his wrongdoing. This according to interviews, court records, and an internal report by the Drug Enforcement Administration. By the time Justice Department officials took Andrew Chambers off the DEA payroll last year, he had wrecked prosecutions of street-level drug traffickers in Florida, Colorado, Missouri, and South Carolina, but had earned about $1.8 million from the government. The DEA knew that Chambers had lied under oath in at least 16 of 25 sworn depositions and trials about his personal arrest record, failure to file tax returns, and education. The agency hid Chambers' action from some prosecutors and defense attorneys, and on at least three occasions, DEA agents paid Chambers' bail, had it reduced, or persuaded judges and prosecutors to drop charges against him. The campaign for federal funding of human embryo cell research gained new political momentum with an announcement by Senator Bill Frist, Republican of Tennessee, that he would back the use of taxpayer dollars in the controversial but promising field. As the Senate's only physician, Frist has been a trusted and influential advisor on medical issues to President Bush, who is trying to decide whether to fund research on embryonic stem cells. Suspense had been building in recent days as rumors spread that the heart surgeon was close to taking a position on the research, which scientists say could lead to treatments for many chronic diseases, but which depends on the destruction of human embryos. The investigative arm of Congress has demanded that Vice President Cheney release information on the development of the administration's energy policy, an action that could lead to a rare court showdown between the executive and legislative branches. The General Accounting Office, alleging that its requests for records of the Energy Task Force Cheney chaired were denied, issued a demand letter requiring the vice president to supply the information with 20 days. Of the 31 demand letters the GAO has ever issued to an administration, this is the first to be sent to a president or vice president. The Washington Post reports the GAO action was sought by Democratic lawmakers suspicious that the administration's energy policy was shaped by industry officials who contributed to President Bush's campaign. Meanwhile, several House committees rest yesterday to complete work on key elements of President Bush's energy proposal by week's end. House Majority Whip Tom DeLay has instructed key House committees, including Resources, Energy and Commerce, Ways and Means, and Science, to finish their work on their respective energy proposals by Friday. In other energy news, after months of grave warnings about power shortages and forced blackouts, an unusually cool July and surprisingly effective conservation efforts have put California in an unexpected position. It has so much electricity on its hands that it's selling its surplus into a glutted market. In fact, California state officials said yesterday, after spending much of the winter and spring scrambling to line up new supplies of electricity at a cost of tens of billions of dollars, the agency that is in charge of buying power has actually been selling some back at a loss this week. Japanese prosecutors today formally charged a U.S. airman with raping a woman on southern Okinawa Island, an incident that has fueled local resentment of the huge U.S. military presence. And this news from South Korea. Villagers living close to a U.S. bombing range vowed today to step up protests against their government's decision to continue allowing U.S. warplanes to use the facility. Thousands of residents of Maeyang-ri, a village on South Korea's central west coast, are angry over the exclusion of the range from plans by the U.S. military to close and consolidate its bases in South Korea beginning next year. The Pentagon said yesterday a prototype missile defense radar had a malfunction after an interception test on Saturday and was unable to confirm that a mock warhead had been destroyed. Pentagon testers are counting X-band radar to help them confirm that the warhead had been destroyed. Instead of doing that, the system froze because it was inundated with data from debris created by the collision. Critics of the Bush administration's missile defense plan said the failure was more significant than the Pentagon was willing to admit. They contend that if the radar locked up when tracking debris from a collision, adversaries could confound it by surrounding their warheads with tiny scraps of metal. In the New York Times today, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace said, "This underscores the unreality of these tests, how carefully choreographed they are for success. They work only as long as everything goes exactly according to plan." And a federal judge, siding with a group of native Hawaiians, temporarily blocked the Army's planned live ammunition training in a remote valley. The group contends that the training could harm endangered species and ancient Hawaiian cultural sites in the Makua Valley on Oahu. African Americans singing civil rights anthems picketed a courthouse in Birmingham to protest a judge's ruling that a former Ku Klux Klansman is mentally incompetent to stand trial in the 1963 church bombing that killed four black girls. Demonstration leaders said Alabama has executed six mentally retarded black men since 1989, yet 72-year-old Bobby Frank Cherry apparently will go free without answering murder charges in the blast at the 16th Street Baptist Church. Angelique Kidjo singing Agolo, love, life, Mother Earth, love, life, Africa, motherland, enjoy the benefits of Mother Earth. Here on Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio, I'm Amy Goodman. 43% of the world's cocoa beans, the raw material in chocolate, come from small scattered farms in the poor West African country of the Ivory Coast. There may be a hidden ingredient in the chocolate cake you bake, the candy bars your children sold for their school fundraiser, or that fudge ripple ice cream cone you enjoyed on Saturday afternoon. It's slave labor. On some of the farms, the hot, hard work of clearing the fields and harvesting the fruit is done by boys who were sold or tricked into slavery. Most of them are between the ages of 12 and 16. Some are as young as 9. The lucky slaves live on corn paste and bananas. The unlucky ones are whipped, beaten, and broken like horses to harvest the almond-sized beans that are made into chocolate treats for more fortunate children in Europe and the United States. Americans spend $13 billion a year on chocolate, but most of them are as ignorant of where it comes from as the boys who harvest cocoa beans are about where their beans go. This is how Sumana Chatterjee and Sudarshan Raghavan, two reporters for Knight Ridder newspapers, have begun their groundbreaking investigation of the cocoa trade in the Ivory Coast and the child slave labor that it depends on. And they're joining us both in the studio here in New York to talk about chocolate and the slave trade, the title of their series, Taste of Slavery. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Well, this is a groundbreaking investigation that you have done, and it began for you months ago with a story that slipped off the radar screen very quickly, but I'm sure troubled a lot of people when they heard about it. And that's the story of the, well, alleged slave ship off the coast of Benin. Can you talk about how you went from there to this investigation?
That's correct, Amy. We had heard about the Benin slave ship. It was in April. It was reportedly off the coast of Benin, and it had apparently had about 200 child slaves heading to various parts of West Africa. But by the time we got there, it was very unclear whether there were actual slaves on the ship. So what we decided to do instead was really look at the root causes of the slavery and fully track to see where the children were going to.
And what did you find in terms of the slave ship? Was this a ship that had children who were slaves on it?
Well, to this day, it's unclear whether there were actual slaves on the ship. Some human rights groups say there were. Others say there's no conclusive proof.
I think we'd probably know a lot more if these kids certainly were U.S. kids or if there was a ship that even there were allegations that there was anything like that going on. But it has inspired you to do this story, to follow the trail of chocolate. Can you begin from the beginning, where you went in the Ivory Coast and why you chose the Ivory Coast?
Absolutely. We visited a number of small farms scattered in the cocoa-producing regions in remote parts of central and southwestern Ivory Coast. On some of these farms, we found boys who were trafficked in from neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso. They said they were sold or tricked into slavery in order to harvest the cocoa that goes in the chocolate we eat. Most of the boys we interviewed were between the ages of 12 and 16. The youngest boy we encountered was 11 years old when he became a slave. What we found was there were a variety of different factors that was causing this the slave trade. The most important, of course, being poverty. The Ivory Coast is a wealthy magnet that attracts its poorer neighbors. In addition, the global cocoa price has also fallen almost 24% since 1996. It used to be 67 cents a pound. Now it's 51 cents. This is forcing the country's impoverished farmers to use the cheapest labor they can find. We also found a number of other factors that are perpetuating this problem. They include inadequate legislation, ignorance of the law, poor law enforcement, porous borders, police corruption, and really a shortage of resources to combat child slavery. On the worst of these farms, the boys said they were whipped with cocoa tree branches and chains. They worked 12 to 14-hour days for no pay, some for as long as 4.5 years. They were fed bananas or yams once or twice a day. At night, they were locked up in a small windowless room and handed a can to urinate in. If they tried to escape, they were made an example and beaten in front of the other boys. The main reason the Ivory Coast is seeing such slavery is because they are the biggest cocoa-producing nation in the world, and much of the cocoa that becomes chocolate in the United States comes from this country.
Now, we're going to spend the hour following this trail. Sudarshan Raghavan is a Nairobi-based reporter for Knight Ridder and did the West Africa part of this story, the harvesting of the cocoa, where the boys are coming from. And we're going to follow the story. I'd like to ask you about one boy, Ali Jabati, and what his story was, how he ended up slave. And the other half of the story is picked up by Sumana Chatterjee, who is a reporter in Washington, D.C. for Knight Ridder. And Sumana, you followed the story once it landed, the coffee, cocoa landed in the United States, and you looked at the corporations like ADM, like Hershey's, Nestle's, and what awareness they have, all represented by the Chocolate Manufacturers Association, and we'll be joined by a representative soon, of where these coffee cocoa beans are coming from. Now, I keep confusing coffee and cocoa, but Sumana, maybe you can tell us why you decided to focus on chocolate, because in fact, coffee is also grown in West Africa.
Coffee is grown in West Africa. They make a small percent. The Ivory Coast makes a small percentage of the world's Robusta beans. Robusta beans are used in basically mixes like Maxwell House and Folgers and Nescafe. But we decided, since it's only a small percentage of the amount of coffee produced worldwide, and it's a small proportionally, it would be a small percentage of the coffee made in that comes into the United States. We decided to focus on chocolate and cocoa because the Ivory Coast is the number one producer of cocoa in the world, and that region produces 70% of the cocoa for the entire world. And so the likelihood of those slave-tainted beans coming to the United States is higher with cocoa than it is with coffee. So that was the sort of editorial decision we made. That said, once those beans leave the port in Abidjan and in Abidjan or in the Ivory Coast, it goes all over the world. It goes to Europe, obviously, to Amsterdam and the ports in Europe, and it comes to the United States. The ports include the one here in Brooklyn, in Philadelphia, in Camden, in Norfolk, in San Francisco. Those are major ports for cocoa. And once they get there, they go to a number of companies which process cocoa beans. And there is a long chain between the actual farmhand in the Ivory Coast to the companies here. And so it was my job to sort of track that along the way.
We're also going to be joined by the legislative director of Elliot Engel, congressman, who's introduced a bill around the issue of slavery and chocolate. But let's go to Sudarshan Raghavan. This one story, we can follow the life of Ali Jabati. Where was he born?
Ali was born in a small village in Mali near the town of Sikasso, which is in southern Mali. He was 11 when he became a slave. He worked for a man named Le Gros, which means the big man in French. Ali is pretty much a shy, soft-spoken kid who was barely 4 feet tall when he was sold in slavery, and he had a hard time carrying the heavy bags of cocoa beans. He told me, some of the bags were taller than me. It took two people to put the bag on my head, and when you didn't hurry, you were beaten. The beatings were a part of my life, he said. Any time they loaded you with bags and you fell while carrying them, nobody helped you. Instead, they beat you and beat you until you picked it up again. Ali was representative of many of the child slaves who come from Mali and Burkina Faso. Like the ones others we interviewed, he left his village searching for a job and some money to bring back to his family. He went along with an older friend, and when they arrived in Sikasso, they were approached by a trafficker who was well dressed and who promised them good jobs in the Ivory Coast, working in shops or as welders. And he also promised to take the boys for free to the Ivory Coast. And they ended up in Korhogo, which is in northern Ivory Coast, where they met with Le Gros. And instead of providing him a nice job in a shop, Le Gros took them to his cocoa plantation. The boys didn't have any money. They didn't speak French, which is most commonly spoken in the Ivory Coast. They had no idea where they were. It was hard for them to return to Mali. So Ali, like many others, ended up staying at Le Gros. He was promised $150 a year, but he never saw a penny.
And when they asked for money, what would happen?
Well, when they asked for money, they were with Le Gros, with the big man, which was basically the worst plantation that we encountered. They were either they were beaten, given empty promises, and they'll get paid later. It varied. There were 19 slaves on the big man's plantation.
When we come back from a break, we'll find out what they did through the day, how they harvested the cocoa beans from the cacao trees, how they understood, if they ever even themselves got to taste the chocolate that we know so well in the United States, and then where the large multinational corporations fit into this and their awareness of what is going on. You are listening to Democracy Now! We're talking to the two reporters who are on the trail of chocolate, Sumana Chatterjee and Sudarsan Raghavan, both reporters for Knight Ridder. Their pieces are appearing in papers around the United States. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. 43% of the world's cocoa beans, the raw material in chocolate, come from small scattered farms in the West African country of the Ivory Coast. Today, we're looking at the trail of chocolate from the Ivory Coast to the United States, and particularly looking at the human slaves that actually harvest this coffee. And they're young, as you heard, as young as 9 years old. Our guests are Sudarsan Raghavan and Sumana Chatterjee. They're both reporters for Knight Ridder, and they've been doing a series that broke in the last few weeks in newspapers, from the St. Petersburg Times to the Miami Herald to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Well, there are pieces that are appearing around the country from the news service on the taste of chocolate. Sudarsan Raghavan, you have the situation of Ali Jabati, who was almost 12 when a slave trader promised him a bicycle and $150 a year. He ends up on this farm plantation in Ivory Coast. He is not being paid anything. How long are his days?
12 to 14-hour days.
And what are they doing? What is he doing?
Well, the cocoa beans come from pods on the cacao tree, and to get the 400 or so beans it takes to make a pound of chocolate, the boys basically cut about 10 pods from the tree, slice them open, scoop out the beans, spread them in baskets or on mats, and cover them up to ferment them. Then they uncover the beans, put them in the sun to dry, bag them, and load them onto trucks to begin the long journey to America or Europe. Sometimes, you know, they walk, you know, as far as a mile with a 50-pound bag of cocoa beans on their head.
And then where do these cocoa beans go?
The cocoa beans end up then in warehouses in cocoa producing towns like Dalawa in the Ivory Coast. Middleman buyers buy the beans from the farmers, and the beans then end up getting mixed in these warehouses. So beans made by paid laborers and beans made by slave laborers are mixed together, and by the time they reach the United States, they are so thoroughly blended into cocoa that there's no way to know which chocolate products are tainted with slavery and which aren't. This is why, I mean, this is one reason why it makes it very difficult to combat this problem. There is no government or corporate agency monitoring these farms, which number as many as more than 600,000, and there really hasn't been an extensive study done on the labor practices on these farms.
You talk about the scarred backs and bodies of these children as they work the fields. In the case of LeGros Farm, this one place, this man was ultimately brought up on charges, which is extremely rare. How come?
Well, the case of LeGros is an interesting one. It is an anomaly, as you point out. The reason why LeGros got caught was a boy managed to escape from the farm and then alerted authorities, who then actually alerted Malian immigrant elders in nearby villages, who then, instead of talking with the Ivory Coast authorities, they ended up calling the Malian consulate. The Malian consulate showed up, the consul general showed up with a couple of gendarmes and freed these boys, all 19 of them, and then basically pressed the Ivory Coast government into bringing up some sort of charges against LeGros. But in the end, LeGros spent only 24 days in prison, and today he's a free man. The Ivory Coast authorities say that that bringing him to trial would be weak because all the boys are now back in Mali.
Now, you describe when the authorities came, there was one boy that was separate from the others who was, tell how they found him and what condition he was in.
Absolutely. The boy you're talking about was he was basically in the worst condition of all the boys. I interviewed Abdoulaye Mako, who was then the Malian consul general in Bouake, which is a town north of Dalawa. He was the one who actually helped free the boys. He went on the field, and this is what he described to me, you know, what he saw on the farm. And he's referring to the boys here. They were tired, slim. They were not smiling, Mako said. Except one child was not there. This one, his face showed what was happening. He was sick. He had excrement in his pants. He was lying on the ground covered with cacao leaves because they were sure he was dying. He was almost dead. He was severely beaten, Mako said. And this one boy was, we did manage to see photographs of him that were taken right after he was seen by a doctor, and it was just absolutely, you know, he not only had beatings, but he also had boils all over his body from poor hygiene. This particular boy, I believe, was 15.
They were locked in at night?
Yes. They were, they were locked in, all 19 of them, in a sort of a dorm-style room, but they were sleeping on wooden planks, and the door was locked from the outside, so they couldn't get out, and they were handed cans to urinate in.
In your investigation, how many slaves did you count yourself?
Yep. We made two 10-day trips to the Ivory Coast in Mali, and we spoke with six slaves who are currently working on the plantations, and six former slaves as well. So a dozen right there. Another 16 of them, we were able to get their stories from legal and medical documents that were provided to us by some sympathetic Ivorian authorities.
Sudarshan Raghavan telling his story of the following the trail of chocolate from Ivory Coast here to the United States, where Sumana Chatterjee picks up the story. So the cocoa is brought to the United States. 43% of the chocolate in the United States comes from this one African country, Ivory Coast. What are the companies that are involved here, and what do they do with it once it arrives in the different ports?
Well, companies like ADM, Cargill, EDF and Mann, which is a British company.
ADM is Archer Daniels Midland.
Archer Daniels Midland. Blommers is a company based out of Chicago in Pennsylvania, and Barry Callebaut. Those are the major processors of chocolate. They take the raw bean And then they put it through all these, add the ingredients like milk and sugar and go through an intensive processing period where then they send it off to mom-and-pop shops all over the country that then use these blocks of chocolate that are sent in by ship or rail or truck to companies around the country. And then those companies like Ghirardelli or Godiva then make their chocolate. Places that are as big as Hershey's, Mars, Nestle's, Russell Stover, they take the raw beans themselves and also do all the processing and make chocolate bars. And so what happens is the Ivory Coast cocoa is valued for its abundance and its quality. And it's mixed in with, let's say, cocoa from Ghana, cocoa from Indonesia, cocoa from Vietnam, cocoa from Brazil, Malaysia. Each of these cocoa beans has its own flavor. You think of it like a wine. It has its own taste profile. And so each company has a secret recipe. They won't tell, when I ask questions about, well, how much Ivory Coast cocoa do you have, do you use, they wouldn't tell me because it's part of a secret recipe. That's assuming that they actually called me back. Many of them did not call me back.
When you started asking questions about slavery and chocolate and what they understood about where those beans came from, what did each of the companies say?
Well, on for about 2.5 months, the companies didn't say anything to me directly. A funny anecdote is that I would call one company, leave a message for their vice president of communications, which you'd think is where a reporter should leave questions, and I wouldn't hear from them. And suddenly the trade association would call me, and I hadn't left a message for the trade association. So this had been happening. The trade association is the Chocolate Manufacturers Association, and to their credit, they were always available for any comment, any question I had.
When we called Hershey's, for example, yesterday, they said that it's the CMA, the Chocolate Manufacturers Association, that's handling all these questions.
And so, yes, and so they did answer my questions. Their answers to my questions evolved over a period of time. For example, in May, Larry Graham, the president of the Chocolate Manufacturers Association, said, "Everyone we have talked to in the country who has worked there for years and years and years has never seen this practice. Even if it exists, then we're going to correct it. That is, if there is a problem." And that's back in May, actually on May 4th, in London, where he is at a cocoa meeting and a cocoa ball, actually. And the Ivory Coast agriculture minister had just finished saying, "This problem does exist. It's a small percentage of the farms. We're going to have to do something about it, and we need your help." The Ivory Coast minister had just told this to the ball, and Larry Grant told me that said that quote to me. A month and a half later, they pretty much said, "Well, okay, it's a problem we're going to have to deal with." And to their credit, they've been working with USAID, which is the U.S. Agency for International Development, in trying to figure out how extensive the problem is and start thinking about ways in which they can deal with it and eradicate slavery over there.
Well, we're joined on the telephone by Susan Smith, who is a spokesperson for the Chocolate Manufacturers Association. Susan Smith, we just heard a very heartrending description of what is going on right now in the Ivory Coast as Sudarshan Raghavan took us from Mali to the Ivory Coast, where boys are taken and enslaved and grow these harvest these cocoa beans, most of them between the ages of 12 and 16, some as young as 9 years old, not paid, locked away at night, beaten up. What is the Chocolate Manufacturers Association response to these revelations?
Well, we certainly strongly condemn many abusive labor practices. I've certainly read the stories, and we've, believe me, over the last couple of months, finally figured out who the right people were to start talking to and figuring out what's going on. And we are committing every resources we can to working with the U.S. government, organizations like the International Labor Organization, who has a history and expertise in working on abusive child labor practice issues, the local West African governments, because after all, it's really those countries who we need to help deal with the problem in their countries, and international development organizations and advocacy groups like Save the Children, to do everything we can to address the problem.
Let me ask you something. I said, what was your response to these revelations? Well, the reporters are just doing the story now, but the Chocolate Manufacturers Association has represented these companies for, is that right, decades, and what and where they get their chocolate from. So how long have you known about slavery?
You know, you would think that we would have known about it, but we really didn't. I think it was late last year that we heard the first mention of it. We talked to people who we thought would know. That includes people in the U.S. government, people in the Ivory Coast. People had been dealing directly with the country for years. Ivorians themselves, and we were told that it didn't exist. And I think sometimes people who are closest to something sometimes can't see the truth or can't see when something new comes out. So we really didn't realize that there was a problem until the Benin slave ship incident, and then we realized that something must be going on. We found by those articles, and so newspaper articles have been really helpful in this, and certainly Zumana and Sudarshan's articles have been helpful too. We found in those articles the people who we should be talking to, and that included UNICEF, that included the ILO, that included Save the Children, that included Slavery International. And it was at that point that we realized there were some, that this kind of thing did exist, and we saw reports and we began working on a plan to deal with the issue.
We're also joined on the telephone by the legislative director for New York Congressperson Elliot Engel, who has introduced a bill calling for labeling of chocolate products. Peter Leon, can you explain what this bill says?
Well, essentially, the amendment sets aside $250,000 for the Food and Drug Administration to develop labeling standards for chocolate products. The label would assure consumers that no child slave labor was involved in the growing or processing of the cocoa in the product.
Explain how these farms would be monitored.
Well, what we envision is that in order to receive the label, which would be sort of a seal of approval, there would be a tracking system set up that would enable chocolate manufacturers and the producers, as well as the federal government, to know where the beans are coming from and to know that the beans on those farms are being grown with a labor standard, and that we could have international labor visitors and experts on site, you know, checking up.
Susan Smith, the Chocolate Manufacturers Association opposes this bill. Why?
We haven't said that we are looking at any kind of answers to the problems. We're certainly willing to look at what everybody has to say. We think there's a better solution, and actually we already have a program in place that's doing the kinds of things that that Congressman Engel is talking about. We're working with the U.S. Agency for International Development on a whole program in the Ivory Coast and other countries in West Africa to first of all determine the extent of the problem, because nobody really knows that. There are 600,000 farms there, and the Ivory Coast is a huge problem. And so to figure out where the problems are, the Ivory Coast needs to know that, and the farmers themselves need to know that. And then through doing this, there'll be a way to establish appropriate labor standards, and then to help farmer co-ops there monitor the situation, monitor the activities, and then there will also be outside monitors such as, I don't know who that will be, but somebody like Save the Children or Slavery International. So those kinds of efforts that the congressman is talking about are really, there's already a process in place to begin to do all of those things.
On your website of the Chocolate Manufacturers Association, there are headlines like, "No need to panic, chocolate supplies are ample, Easter baskets filled with goodies, America votes for chocolate." Why is there nothing on your website about the labor conditions of the people who pick the cocoa beans that make your chocolate? I mean, if these are revelations to you as well, why nothing about slavery and what you're doing about it?
Well, actually, there is, and I know we just redesigned our website, so you may not have been able to see it. We couldn't change the front page very well. But at the very, for the last month or month and a half, there has been a release.
This is from yesterday that I was referring to.
No, but you know what? I think it's there because you just, I couldn't find it either. It was at the bottom of the webpage. So it has been. We have a couple of websites, and it is on the website.
Well, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll come back with Susan Smith of the Chocolate Manufacturers Association, Peter Leon, Legislative Director for New York Congressmember Elliot Engel, who has a death in the family, so couldn't join us, who's introduced a bill calling for labeling of chocolate products, and our guests in the studio, two Knight Ridder reporters who are on the trail of chocolate. A Taste of Slavery is their series that's appearing in newspapers around the country, Sudarshan Raghavan and Sumana Chatterjee. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we're on the trail of chocolate. A Taste of Slavery is the explosive investigative series that two Knight Ridder reporters are now publishing around the country in newspapers that run Knight Ridder stories. Sumana Chatterjee and Sudarshan Raghavan are in the studio with us. They're here in New York. Usually Sudarshan is based in Nairobi, Sumana in Washington, because they'll be part of a panel tonight that is sponsored by the Freedom Forum, where they'll be discussing this issue. We were just talking about the bill that New York Congressmember Elliot Engel has introduced to label chocolate products. We are on the line with Peter Leon and Susan Smith, a spokesperson for the Chocolate Manufacturers Association. Peter Leon, can you respond to Susan Smith saying this is not necessary? The companies can take care of the monitoring of the 600,000 farms in the Ivory Coast.
Well, we just are of the opinion that, in fact, the labeling requirement would strengthen their hand when they go to the farmers and the co-ops that they work with to say that, you know, in order to sell their products here in the United States, they need this label. So they are going to have to institute some changes that are verifiable using labor monitors such as the International Labor Organization. You know, we're of the opinion that if we could do this for dolphins on tuna cans, we certainly can do this for kids on chocolate bars. And that's sort of the essence of where we've been driving from.
Sumana Chatterjee, we're not just talking about consumer products for the general population, you know, M&Ms, Hershey bars, etc. But the U.S. government also buys a lot of chocolate. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The U.S. government buys chocolate. The Defense Department buys tons and tons of cocoa, actually, millions of dollars worth of chocolate bars for the troops and to put in their ready-to-eat meals and put in the commissaries around the world and here in the United States. And so the Department of Labor is looking at whether or not to put cocoa on a list of products that would be banned from being purchased by the federal government. Back in 1999 in June, President Clinton at that time signed an executive order saying that if something has been made with child indentured labor, forced labor, then it shouldn't be bought by the federal government. And he instructed the Department of Labor to work out a list. And so they've started to put stuff on that list. It includes products from Burma. It includes soccer balls from Pakistan. And now they're looking at whether or not cocoa should be on that. if cocoa is put on that list, then the Chocolate Manufacturers Association will have to reach a higher burden to get the contracts that they're now really covet. There's a fight every year. Every time this comes up, the contracts come up. There is an intense competition between Hershey's and Mars to get that contract. Another issue that they may look at down the road is whether or not coffee should be from the Ivory Coast should be on this. These product lists are for specific products coming from specific countries. The decision from the Department of Labor will be late this summer, maybe early fall.
We know about the anti-sweatshop movement very well. There may be a growing anti-sweet shop movement. But Susan Smith, a spokesperson for the Chocolate Manufacturers Association, how are you dealing with this?
I think we're concerned, and there's reason to be concerned that if you start doing things like that, and you do things like labeling, that the immediate result of that is to, unfortunately, affect all the cocoa farmers in the Ivory Coast. And the survey will tell us how many of them use abusive child labor practices, but probably most of the cocoa farmers there are they have owned 1 to 2 hectare farms, so they are probably not doing this. And what happens is if you implement something that bans a product from a certain country, you end up hurting farmers whose livelihood depends on cocoa and whose family's livelihood depends on that cocoa. So again, what we're really interested in doing is a long-lasting solution to the problem that will help the Ivory Coast deal with the issue, that will help eradicate the practice, and that won't hurt the 600,000 small farmers in the Ivory Coast.
Do you support long-term independent monitoring of these farms?
Yes.
That you would allow human rights groups to go into investigating, you know, where slaves are being used?
There's a whole system that needs to be put in place, but after it's determined where this kind of thing exists and after the appropriate labor standards are established there are already groups like that involved in the process. The International Labor Organization is one of them. So they're already offering us expertise. They're already telling us how to do the surveys. They're already helping us figure out the monitoring system. So we are supportive of and very much need their help. But it's not just us who needs their help, but the Ivory Coast government needs their help to make sure that the situation doesn't exist.
We're talking about chocolate in the Ivory Coast, also known as more familiarly Côte d'Ivoire, the French name for the Ivory Coast. Susan Smith, Chocolate Manufacturers Association, Peter Leon, Legislative Director for New York Congressperson Elliot Engel, who's introduced a bill. Is there also a bill introduced in the Senate?
Well,
Simona?
What's happened with Engel's measure, it's an amendment to an agricultural appropriations bill. So it's a must-do bill that has to get done by the end of the year. So it's got a little bit of legs on it. The Senate is, there are senators over on the Senate side who are looking at offering a similar amendment to their agricultural appropriations bill. So what ends up happening, sort of the legislative process, is that assuming that it passes on the Senate side, these both will go in conference, and then we'll really see whether or not it will make it through the negotiation period and get signed into law.
Susan Smith has said that they're concerned about supporting the 600,000 small farmers in Ivory Coast. Sudarshan Raghavan, what about that point of how you determine where there are slaves, where there aren't?
Well, there, as Susan mentioned, you know, there are a number of groups who are really starting to look into this, such as UNICEF and Save the Children Canada. There are also an entire network of Malian immigrant communities all over the Ivory Coast who are also trying to look into the problem. They're gathering a census of where trafficked kids are in their particular areas. So one way of doing this is to get in touch with these groups. But once again, it is a formidable task with, you know, more than 600,000 farms.
How difficult was it for you to go onto the farms and find these children?
The farms were in remote areas, the ones we visited, so it was physically tough to get there. But overall, I mean, we spent two 10-day trips, and we're able to, you know, have 28, you know, boys, slaves that we had either spoken to or had seen, or had been able to determine what their conditions were through documents. If you go through the right people, it's not too hard to find them.
And then
I just wanted to add that Susan Smith had said that we were told, even by the Ivory Coast government, that it doesn't exist, and all the people that they had talked to, that it doesn't exist. And child slavery can be a very invisible part of the community, and because it is, you don't necessarily put your slaves out in front. It does take a little, you know, person who's looking out and looking and asking the right questions. But also, because it was so easy for Sudarshan to get on the farms, it makes me wonder whether or not that it's an acceptable practice.
Well, one of the just add to that a bit. The thing is, in most of these farms, as Susan mentioned, many of them are family run, and there are children all over these farms. So, in that sense, it makes it more invisible to determine which are child laborers and which are child slave laborers. I mean, what we did was, we used a very strict definition, someone who was bought and sold by people, who wasn't paid at all for long hours of work or paid a fraction of what he was owed, who wasn't free to leave his job, who was controlled by others through fear and abuse, both physical and psychological. In order to find these boys, one needs to go onto these farms, no matter how remote they are, and really talk to the kids and the farmers.
The Chocolate Manufacturers Association says they're going to they're involved in a study now to see where the slaves are. Susan Smith, why should people continue to buy chocolate if they can't be sure that slave labor isn't being used in cocoa production today or tomorrow?
As Sudarshan just said, I wish that we could snap our fingers and that we could take care of the problem, but it doesn't happen that quickly. As he just said, it's very difficult to figure it out. However, we're working with a group. It's called the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture. They are located in, they have offices in the Ivory Coast, and the headquarters, I believe, are in the Cameroon. They are also working with labor experts, the right people who know how to figure out what's going on and who can figure out where this is occurring and how to deal with it and put the process in place to do whatever we can to eradicate it, are working on this. So I hope that people will realize that it's a process that takes time to go into the country and to help people realize, what appropriate labor practices are too, and to put that in place.
Right now, you have a study that's going, and I think a lot of activists understand that when they start first putting pressure on, a stalling mechanism of large companies is to say, let's do a study. Since you acknowledge that there is slavery now in the Ivory Coast, slaves being used to harvest the cocoa that the companies like Hershey's, Mars, Nestle's, and others, ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, is profiting from enormously. What about pouring money, and maybe this is a naive question, into a trust that will pay for independent monitoring, a massive independent monitoring program immediately to ensure that no person ends up like the 15-year-old boy Sudarshan was just describing, laying in his own excrement, about to die from the whippings?
Monitoring only works when you know where to look for the abusive practice. I don't know. The Ivory Coast is a very large country, and the reporters, I believe, went into one or two areas. There were large cocoa-growing areas, but it's a very large country. That kind of monitoring program works when you know where the activities are. And the survey that we're talking about, that people are actually on the ground right now getting it going, that will be done by the end of the year, and the results will be shared with everyone and with all the groups who could be available in such a monitoring exercise. So what you're talking about is really already going forward.
Sudarshan Raghavan, did you see that happening, monitors around the country?
Oh no! I mean, when I was there in April and May, I mean, there's absolutely no monitors whatsoever. I mean, this is something that the Chocolate Manufacturers Association and others are just about to launch. There are no monitors anywhere.
What I was saying is the process to do that has already begun, and we will have the results by the end of the year to be able to implement the monitoring. It can't be done unless you know where everything is happening.
From what I understand, USAID is doing the training as part of the training process for these surveys, and they are working really closely with the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture. And so they're in the process of doing that, but like you said, there's no instant guarantee that the chocolate or candy bar that I've eaten isn't tainted.
I mean, this is a phenomenon that has just recently come to light. I mean, a lot of, including, you know, various West African governments were in, you know, total, including Ivory Coast, were in total denial before. And they're just now starting to react to this problem.
The Ivory Coast itself, the country, how is it dealing with international treaties around child slavery?
Well, the Ivory Coast government is yet to sign the ILO, the International Labor Organization Convention on Child Labor, which would basically protect, give child rights to people such as Ali Diabate. But they, from what I understand, in the next few weeks they are about to sign it. But you know, it really wasn't done until after intense international pressure. I mean, the Ivory Coast government is especially concerned about an international boycott of their cocoa.
Mm-hmm. And by signing it, I mean, it sounds like one of those things that someone signs and maybe forgets about. But by signing it, they are committing to higher standards of enforcement for child labor practices and working conditions for children, and a ban on the worst forms of slavery, worst forms of child labor, which includes slavery. And will be held accountable by an international community on that and, you know, by journalists.
Well, we want to give our listeners some contact information to get more information. If people want to read your series, A Taste of Slavery, where can they find it? They can look in their local newspapers, your Night Ritter.
And they can go to www.krwashington.com. That's krwashington.com. And then you'll see, in addition to the stories we put out every day from the Washington Bureau, we have a little chocolate bonbon on the right-hand side. It says, A Taste of Slavery. You click on that icon, and it takes you entirely to all the series, including all the follow-ups we're doing, following what's happening in Congress, in the federal government, in the Ivory Coast, and anything further on these monitoring efforts in the Ivory Coast.
There's also websites like the Anti-Slavery International Group, www.antislavery.org, and Save the Children. Susan Smith, what is the website or phone number of the Chocolate Manufacturers Association?
The website is www.candyusa.org, CANDYUSA.org, and there is something on the front page on the West African labor issue. Our phone number is 703-790-5011.
And finally, Peter Leon, if people want to call about the bill of New York Congressmember Elliot Engel, what are they asking about? What is the name of the bill?
Well, there's no name of the bill. It was an amendment to the Agricultural Appropriations Bill. So the easy thing to do is call it the Engel Amendment. And if they're calling their senators, that's what they should refer to.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. Peter Leon from New York Congressmember Elliot Engel's office, Susan Smith from the Chocolate Manufacturers Association, and Sudarshan Raghavan and Sumana Chatterjee, the reporters for Knight Ritter, who are doing this series called A Taste of Chocolate. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Let me correct that title of the series, A Taste of Slavery. If you'd like to email us, you can send it to mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.